FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. The date is June 15th, 2016. Coincidentally with this interview, a Fed meeting is coming up, but we didn't have anything to do with that. But with me is John Tamney. You know him well. You're familiar with his work. He writes for Forbes magazine, and he's got a new book that just came out entitled Who Needs the Fed? And that's a great question. And also had, John, you also just had an article come out the day before the book was released in Forbes entitled On the Subject of Inflation, Janet Yellen Always Brings the Comedy. And the money quote in this article, John, that you, I mean, you always just have such a great way of stating things that we all know and we all are sure of, but you just come up with ways of saying it. And here you said, if there's a discredited idea in economics, it's almost certain that Yellen believes it. So first, welcome back. It's been too long. And thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, so what is it with Janet Yellen? I mean, she's definitely the person that that Austrian economists and other free market people love to hate. But, you know, is she willfully stupid, or is there a nefarious plan at foot that none of us really know about?
I think what it is that if you spent your life studying something that is so common sense, if you believe that you need to graph an equation and chart something that is so basic, you're automatically going to believe a lot of dumb things. Economics is not a dismal science. It's just a study of human action. It's a study of why people do things. Yellen is not willfully blind, but she's just confused. And her confusion begins with this notion that you need to learn what is common sense.
Yeah, well, and you start the article with a quote from one of my favorite people who set me off down the path of free market economics, Ludwig von Mises. Don't be afraid to say anything, because no matter what you say, no matter how idiotic it is, it has already been said by some eminent economist. And that kind of sums it all up. You know, they're always saying stupid things, and it's kind of like the earth is green, and if you eat too much food, too many fattening things, you will gain weight, right? I mean,
yeah.
I mean, what is it here?
Kind of common sense doesn't fly with economists. And Yellen is a classic example of this. In the article, she makes this point frequently that, in fact, too much economic growth, as in too many people working and prospering, is a bad thing because it causes inflation. But in fact, as we look throughout history, what we see is that any time the economy is growing, that's the surest sign that all the things that we want are falling in price, and in a substantial way. Exactly the opposite of what Yellen assumes.
Yeah, and Milton Friedman said it, and I think he said it well, even though there's a lot of things he did say and did that I don't agree with. But he said, inflation, first and foremost, is a monetary phenomena. It's not just consumer prices rising. It's the amount of money, and in our case, money is credit in this day and age, increasing, right?
Well, I would say it's a little bit different from that. To me, inflation is just a decline in the value of the unit, in our case, the dollar. Usually I use gold as the evidence of a decline in the value of the dollar. Yellen thinks it's too much economic growth. It's not. It's monetary. But I would say it's not even the way Friedman says it. Friedman always said that if there's too much money and too much money supply, that's a sign of inflation. Well, let's face it, a quality currency is going to be heavily circulated. There's going to be lots of demand for a currency that's good. No productive person would want to earn dollars or any currency that are losing value. So if you have good money, you're going to have abundant supply. But as long as its price is being maintained, there's no problems, and there's certainly no inflation.
Yeah. Correct. Correct. So I haven't read about this in your writing, but Bitcoin's on a tear now, getting close to $700, broke $700 a while ago. What are your feelings about Bitcoin? Do you see a role for it in the future monetary system?
Well, I think Bitcoin is a response to terrible monetary policy from the Bush Treasury that largely for a long time continued under the Obama Treasury. Let's face it, the dollar fell in value an enormous amount. If you accept gold as a good objective indicator, the dollar bought 1/260th of an ounce of gold in 2001. By the time Bush left office, it bought 1/800th of an ounce. By August of 2011, a dollar bought 1/1900th of an ounce. Well, that's inflation. The value of the dollar sank in value enormously. And so Bitcoin, I think, is a response. People don't trust government-issued money as much anymore. The mistake of Bitcoin, and it's largely a Friedmanite mistake, is that they're focused on supply. Well, the supply of money doesn't matter. What matters is that the currency holds its value. And so Bitcoin it's a very volatile currency. And so that makes it not as useful. Eventually, market forces are going to come up with a currency that holds its value, that buys, let's just say for fun, the same amount of gold tomorrow as it will a year from now and 10 years from now. And when that happens, that's going to be a very desirable currency because people will be able to transact with it. They'll be able to make deals with it over long time frames, precisely because a dollar will hold its value. That's historically what money was supposed to do.
And that is, in fact, what the U.S. dollar did from 1776 to the advent of the Federal Reserve, with the exception of a few wars like the War of 1812 and the Civil War when you had the advent of the greenback. However, during that time, excluding the wars and then the period of normalization after the war, where the dollar, the inflation was effectively wrung out of the currency, the dollar kept its value for 150 years, basically, close to it.
It did. Well, the dollar was defined in terms of gold for a very long time. Where I would probably see it differently from Austrians, and let me stress that my book is very much a tribute to Ludwig von Mises's The Theory of Money and Credit. I think it's one of the, it's almost underrated, so brilliant is the book. But I make the argument that the true blame for the dollar's decline since the Fed began shouldn't necessarily fall on the Fed. If you look at the major devaluations of the dollar since 1913, the first one was in 1933. That was wholly FDR's decision. The Fed was violently against it. In fact, Fed Chairman Eugene Meyer resigned over FDR's decision to devalue the dollar from 1/20th of an ounce of gold to 1/35th. And then the next major devaluation was 1971. That was President Nixon's decision. That was the U.S. Treasury's decision. They were egged on by, you guessed it, Milton Friedman,
yes,
who strangely believed that floating money that has no specific value is actually better than a stable currency defined in terms of gold. But it should be stressed there that Fed Chairman Arthur Burns begged Nixon, please do not do this. This is such a bad decision to delink the dollar from gold, and the Fed was ignored. I'm not defending the Fed, but but it's very clear, at least historically, that presidents have gotten the dollar they want.
Yeah, it's been a political matter. So political,
yes.
And who elects the politicians? So is it the people who elected the politicians, the presidents who got what they wanted with the current currency unit in its current state then, John? Or did we effectively get more than we bargained for when we elected those people?
We got much worse than we bargained for, but you hit it so well in that it's a political concept. John F. Kennedy had it drummed into his head by his father that you never leave the gold standard. He said that is a good dollar is the basis for trade and contractual arrangements around the world. FDR didn't quite buy it, but Nixon, of course, ultimately severed the link altogether. Where it gets interesting is Ronald Reagan ran on returning to the gold standard. And where it gets even more interesting is after he won New Hampshire in 1980, the price of gold fell substantially, as in the dollar strengthened. And that was the market's way of basically predicting well ahead of the polls that Reagan was going to be elected. Presidents get the dollar they want. Let's move to President Clinton. It's interesting with him in that once Robert Rubin took over at Treasury, Not once did a responsible Treasury official, and figure Treasury is the mouthpiece of the dollar, that the Fed is not is told not to comment on the dollar generally at all. Not once did a responsible Treasury official ever complain about the value of the yen vis-a-vis the dollar. And so this was a very strong signal from the Clinton administration that it meant what Rubin was saying about how a strong dollar is in the best interests of the American people and the U.S. economy. And the dollar was strong, and naturally the economy did very well with the dollar fairly stable during the Reagan and Clinton years. The mistake from there, of course, is that once George W. Bush got into office, he wanted a weak dollar and markets complied, and we got a lousy economic result.
So let's look at this, the globalist outlook that a weak dollar is somehow good for the U.S. economy. And yet, for international trade purposes, we can't go on forever running these unbelievable trade deficits, not healthy for the economy at home, not healthy for the international economy, and not good for the reserve currency status for the dollar. So something's got to be done for the trade position of the United States to reduce these trade deficits, right?
I would probably dispute that somewhat. Let's remember, countries don't trade, just individuals do. I run, and an economy is just a collection of individuals. I run massive trade surpluses, or I'd like to think they're massive with my employers, but I run trade deficits with my landlord, with the people who sold me a car, with my grocer, with the restaurants I like to go to. Trade deficits are just the reward for the work that we do. Let's face it, the U.S. gets imports from around the world precisely because we're very productive. Why can we import more than we export? That's just an accounting abstraction. Precisely because so much investment flows into the United States, we export shares in the most valuable companies in the world. And so we export them. And then what do we get in return? We get the shoes, socks, T-shirts, televisions, frequently cars, the goods that aren't worth our time to make in return for this. And so trade always balances. Let's face it, as individuals, our trade balances. And so I think that's a good thing. I think the mistake is that politicians and people at Treasury and Fed, of course, the Fed believes this, they believe that we can enhance our economic position by devaluing the currency. Well, that just defies basic economic logic.
Oh, for certain. Yeah. So the Fed's also become kind of the country's central economic planner too, hasn't it, John?
It has, but what I point out in the book, and it's, again, it's a very optimistic book. It says that the Fed's relevance has probably always been overstated, but it's certainly in decline. Let's think about this. The Fed's channel through which it presumes to influence the economy, through which it tries to centrally plan, as you say, the economy, is the U.S. banking system. Well, banks in the U.S. account for 15% of total lending in the U.S. economy. And that number is in free fall right before our eyes. The main reason for this is technology. There's just so many different ways that people can deposit their savings that don't involve traditional banks. And let's face it, most lending does not come through the banking system. And so that's the first thing. The other thing, and this is sad, but it springs from the bailouts in 2008 that shouldn't have happened, is banks so owe their existence to the federal government today that they're not allowed to be dynamic at all in the lending of money. And so the fascinating thing about this is that as the Fed vastly overregulates the banks that it couldn't possibly regulate effectively, what it's doing is suffocating them. But by extension, it's ending itself as a relevant institution, because as the banks shrink as a source of credit, the Fed's influence shrinks before our eyes. And that's a beautiful thing.
Well, we see that the velocity of money is at an all-time low, which purportedly is a bad thing for the economy. But also, I think that underscores the argument you're making that the Fed's relevance, and therefore, by extension, the institutions that owe its existence to the Fed and that it regulates, also are becoming less relevant. You're right on the money there, so to speak. Sector is becoming, and we've got an over-financialized economy here, right? The financial sector became way too important to the overall economy by virtue of of a lot of factors, right? Didn't this happen?
Well, yeah, and yes, definitely. In a sense, that's a good thing. Finance has become more and more innovative, and that's a great thing. Let's face it, before junk bonds and Michael Milken, it was very hard for non-blue chip companies to attain a lot of credit. Finance is always figuring out ways to make it possible for those of us in the economy to access the credit, which is money. But what we're really accessing per von Mises is trucks, tractors, desks, chairs, computers, and labor to fund our brilliant ideas. And so that's a good thing. But what's been very sad and unfortunate is before 1971, banks and investment banks didn't have currency trading departments. There was no need for it because the dollar was stable. What would you trade?
Yeah.
And commodity trading was very much a dead institution also, because with the dollar stable, the price of oil and other commodities were very stable. And so what you've seen over the last 40 years is all these talented minds doing something that's necessary. Someone had to trade the chaos. We need them. But what you have to ask yourself, think of the unseen. Think of the cancer cures. Think of the transportation innovations that would make the airplane seem kind of dated. Think of the technological innovations that would make the internet seem dated that never took place precisely because so many talented people like George Soros, like Paul Tudor Jones, like John Paulson, the list is long, got into the trading of the chaos rather than creating the things, the advances that would make our lives exponentially better, that would make us healthier, wealthier, all those things. We've lost immeasurable amounts of economic growth since 1971 precisely because the dollars had no definition. So that aspect of the financialization of the economy has been a disaster.
Yeah, and
we trade $5 trillion a day. That's what goes into currency trading on a daily basis. Think of all the talent that we've lost because of that.
The talent, and this has also led to overregulation and more people going into law and lost talent there as well. So
absolutely,
you know, it's not just the financialization. It's other areas as well that over legalization, if you will, regulation, all these things that have really knocked the economy and diverted resources. This is all from the government becoming too big, too important an influence in the overall economy.
Without question.
Yeah. And
you talk about regulation. Regulation by definition doesn't work because you're asking those who couldn't get jobs in those industries to oversee those who could. It's like asking St. Mary's to beat the Golden State Warriors on an annual basis. Well, that's not going to happen. Regulators will always be last to the problems within any industry. Markets and investors are always the first. Mm-hmm. And so we have to ask the question again, the unseen. Think how much more advanced our economy would be today if the dollar had been stable the last 40 years. Think how much more investment would have gifted us with enormous advances. And think how much more advances we would have had if so many talented individuals weren't trading, but also, as you point out, serving as lawyers and all these different jobs meant to basically just deal with government. The resource wastage has been staggering.
Yeah, it's really awful. It's a waste. And as a former retired attorney myself, I can say firsthand that there were so many people in law school who just should have never been there. For myself, I had specific reasons for being there. I always wanted to be, but most of these people were not Clarence Darrow's, and there was no love of the law there. They just wound up there because it was an easy way to make a buck. And, they just wound up there. So, yeah, it's malinvestment of human capital on just a gargantuan scale that really has hurt the country. A lot of these people would have wound up as engineers in manufacturing, running factories and things of that nature. And, you can never get them back. Once they go on the dark side, that's kind of it. So your book, Who Needs the Fed? So we get rid of the Fed, where the Fed kind of falls into irrelevance. What are we left with then, John? What happens?
Well, it's a pretty exciting thing. I mean, I argue in the book, of course, get rid of the Fed. Why would you have it? It serves no useful purpose. But even if not, the Fed is dying before our eyes because its channel is a banking system that is shrinking before our eyes as a source of credit. But why get rid of the Fed? It's fairly easy. It began as a lender of last resort. But as we've found over the last 100 years, it began as a lender of last resort for solvent banks. Yet no solvent bank would ever go to the Fed for a loan. That is unheard of because there are too many credit sources away from the Fed. To go to the Fed is an admission of bankruptcy. Hence, the solvent don't go to the Fed. And then you want insolvent to be allowed to fail or be acquired by their competitors.
Or shut down.
Fed is a bank regulator. Yeah, shut them down. They'll be acquired by someone who can do a better job. Regulator, the Fed's been a disaster as a bank regulator by definition. Among others, it's bailed out Citigroup 5 times in the last 25 years. It doesn't serve a good purpose there. That's weakened, not strengthened the banking system. Yeah. And then the Fed sets the borrowing rate between banks. Well, let's face it, an interest rate's a price like any other. The economy comes up with prices all the time. We would not need the Fed to set a Fed funds rate. And so if you got rid of it, we wouldn't notice it. Things better, we'd be better off. But even if we keep it, again, banks are yesterday. They are the least dynamic source of credit in the U.S. economy today, and that's why they're shrinking as a source of credit. Okay, if the Fed wants to play around with banks that don't matter, that's fine because it just means that the Fed's relevance is dying before our eyes.
Yeah, and to me, the best point of this is, and the best proof of what you're saying, the one big bank that didn't need a bailout during the 2008-09 crisis was Wells Fargo. What bank has grown the most since the crisis and the bailouts? I mean, they were forced to take the bailout, Wells Fargo, because the Fed's twisted logic was, well, if you don't take it, then everybody's going to put their money with you because you'll be you'll stand out as not being affected by the crisis. So what bank is
what should happen
and exactly what did happen, because the word got out anyway. What bank is the biggest bank in the country now and has grown the most? Wells Fargo. Isn't it ironic that wound up happening, John?
Well, you put it so well, because the one insight Bernanke came up with throughout all of 2008 is, as you point out, they forced TARP on everyone so that the banks that actually needed it wouldn't be exposed. But Bernanke said, you think that's not going to get out into the marketplace very quickly? Who needs it and who doesn't? And so you're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. So that's what we're left with. So who needs the Fed? By John Tamney. And John, is there a website we can go to get it? You have a website, or should we just go to Amazon and BNN, Barnes & Noble?
Yeah, you can go to Amazon.com. Barnes & Noble has it. And so I promise it's a very optimistic book about what's ahead. The Fed is dying before our eyes, and it just shows you how, if you look throughout history, the Fed hasn't been as influential as expected, that the Fed has always been backwards in what it's done. And so market forces have naturally been innovating around it for a long time. So I think people really enjoy it. It's an entirely different but very optimistic look at Fed credit, money, and where we're headed.
All right, John, it's great having you on, and you'll find the links to get the book on our website, financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Make sure you sign up for the newsletter and check out our interview yesterday with Roger Stone, ace political insider operative who's been around for half a century. It was really quite compelling. John, we'll definitely have you on again soon. Keep up the great work, and we'll look forward to your next book coming out hopefully in the next few months. And hey, we'll talk again soon. Be well.
Thanks for having me on.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.